Good morning. Today is Monday, January the 2nd. Happy football day, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Probably pretty much what it is for most, right?
Yeah.
Or if one is inclined to have acted foolishly, perhaps you're still working down a headache, a hangover.
No better way to get rid of it than watching football.
So. Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say playing football. okay. Why do we say that? Are you ready?
Let's give it a shot, Brian.
Why do we say we build a fire under somebody?
Well, I would assume that, you know, when we talk about trying to motivate people, if you would build a fire under someone, that would probably make them move a little quicker to get away from where they're at or to do what you would like them to do. So it probably has some condensation back to
the farm.
The farm, huh?
Just yeah. End your agony now.
Thanks. I try.
A mule, half brother to a horse, is among the sturdiest work animals, but in and out of season, it's likely to be ornery and very stubborn. When all four legs are spread out, an animal can take such a firm stand that neither coaxing nor beating will make him budge. Cotton belt farmers adopted a desperate course of action. When everything else failed, here we go, a small fire was built under the mule's belly in hopes that once in action, the animal could be guided and kept moving. This expedient figured in many yarns and jokes. It probably wasn't nearly tried as often as what a lot of people think. But occasional actual incidents and numerous stories brought a new phrase into speech. Regardless of what is actually intended, a person may borrow from the lingo of a mule skinner and threaten to build a fire under a person that he hopes to get into movement.
Had the movement piece.
So yeah, the fire part you meant. But, you know, you're a cop, you're not a fire dude, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. New Year's, new challenges? New Year, same old challenges.
Probably a little bit of both. There's, obviously the landscape of society hasn't changed that much over a couple of days, but there's always new challenges. We're internally promoting new sergeants to three brand new sergeants on January 9th. They'll take over new watches.
We just
promoted our two commanders. So internally,
are you going to give names or are you just going to give titles?
Sergeant Greg Hill and Sergeant LaFrance will be promoted January 1st to the role of commander. Sergeant Hill will oversee.
Lenny's in charge of more people now?
Yes, he is.
Oh, no.
He's doing a fine job. Commander Hill will be in charge of all patrol operations. Commander LaFrance will be in charge of all special teams. So CSET, criminal investigations, our POP team when they come back.
So they stay in the same areas of responsibility.
For now, it's the easiest for the transition to get them used to their new roles. And then we promoted three sergeants who will take their promotions are effective January 1st also, and that's Jonathan Eckert, Young Bunky, and Brian Ross.
What's the difference from a lieutenant to a commander? I mean, obviously it's a different level of management, but is it significantly different, or is it a lot of transferable from what they had before?
So we don't have the rank of lieutenant, so what we have is sergeants and commander and then assistant chief. And the idea behind the commander position is it's a mid-management position with the ability to have room to mentor, train, and have more hands-on involvement with those below them, their sergeants, their supervisors below them. So the chief and I will take off most of the administrative responsibilities from the commanders, leaving them more room and time to spend time with their sergeants, spend time with their units.
Still be cops.
Exactly.
So and you guys are less cops.
It feels like it
pretty much every day.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you get into the senior positions, yeah. I mean, if you're out there running around chasing the bad guy, then
that's a little
something
hard to,
wrong.
It's a little hard to supervise. I'm not going to give it up completely.
Yeah.
But it's a little hard to run a scene if you're involved in the scene and do the necessary requirements of your job. So.
Yeah, but at least when you communicate to yourself, it should be 100% knowledge.
That is true. And there's a lot of that that takes place. So a lot of that.
How much administrative work is there in a police department? I mean, you know, we see the cruisers. Okay, there's probably somebody who has to maintain them every once in a while and take care of that. And Yeah, we see some of the records or hear about records keeping and things of that nature, but we don't really get to see the business side of the business.
It's huge, actually. So records, just the amount of new laws that have come into place with requirements for reporting certain crimes, NIBRS, the federal reporting system went into effect, which changed a 70-year process on how crimes are reported to the federal government now. So it changed our entire report writing system and what the officers need to do. Everything has an effect. So, they've changed a new law, they changed a new process that has an effect on the officers, stop data, all those things we have to do now for California law. So our records division gets those reports in, gets all that documentation, has to create those reports to DOJ, to the FBI, send those out. And that's all on top of doing fingerprints for the community and creating cases of the arrests that we make and preparing those cases to send to the DA's office, answering subpoenas. We're still processing probably 15, 20,000 cases that we still have on paper that we're scanning into our system, trying to get all of those digital.
Those are just catching up?
Yeah. So we've started a new system and we've been backlogging all these cases over the years. We've gotten rid of tens of thousands of cases that have been scanned now into our system.
So 15 or 20 is a small pile compared to where you started.
Compared to where we started, it was huge. Yeah. We had cases that went back in paper to the 70s. So we're processing that and catching up. And that's just the icing on what records does on a daily basis. There's so much. We have a property room that is responsible for hundreds of thousands of pieces of property. And not only the safety
room?
Room, yeah.
House?
That's
wing?
Most of the second floor of our building, yes. But not only just the chain of command or chain of custody of those items, making sure they get to court, making sure they're properly documented. But, going back in, now we're repackaging all our high crimes, all our homicides, all our rape cases, making sure we have all that, putting them in different packages, barcoding them, because, back cases in the 50s and 60s, we have to keep them forever. And they're all handwritten on the bag, case numbers and stuff. So with the new system, we're getting all that stuff barcoded, repackaged. So now we just scan the outside of the new package, and it says these are all the items that are in there.
So it's kind of forcing you to become a little bit more efficient, but there's just so much volume.
It is. The process alone is just time-consuming.
I don't suppose that stuff you can use volunteers for.
In some capacities you can, but property room, you've got to be really careful with who we allow in there to do that. So it's internal, our property coordinator, and then other employees that have time to come and assist with the packaging. Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about Chicken of the Sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Brian Stevens, Assistant Chief. You've been Assistant Chief for a while, huh?
Since November, I think November 1st, October 1st.
Of last year?
Now, yes, it is. Of last year.
That's what I was setting it up for, was the last year part. So the business side. Maintaining is one thing, but there's a ton, at least we hear that there's a ton of grant writing that goes on. Is that a law enforcement thing? Do you have a grant writer? Do you contract out for somebody? How does that part of the equation work?
Yeah, we don't have a grant writer. We write our own grants. Some of our personnel become very efficient in it. But the OTS, the Office of Traffic Safety Grant, we wrote that one. Measure Z, we write our Measure Z applications in-house. We work with city officials and some other city departments, so like our CSET team, Uplift, and our new CARE program. They all work together to write grants for the mental health services and positions that we have. But yeah, we don't have like a particular grant writer. It's a lot of work to not only prepare the grant, get the money for the grant, but then managing the grant and the reporting side of the house.
That's where I would think after getting the money is probably the easier part of the process once it's here. Okay, and here's all the information that they need, and here's how often they need it, and this is how they need to have it presented, and. You're not using a sworn for that, are you?
No, we have police analysts that generally will oversee the grants, make sure all the bills are being paid, money's being reimbursed, and how that all works, and we'll do the final reporting. But Commander LaFrance has worked closely with CSET or Uplift and the CARE program, other people in the city to write grants and try to be a part of that process to get the money. And then on the back end, we're out of it. Somebody else deals with the reporting.
Oh, so they won't spot check just to see, hey, how's it going, guys?
Yeah. They spot check. We write quarterly for Measure Z. We write quarterly reports. Every 4 months, we write a report to Measure Z. We have to do our budget. We have to
quarterly every 4 months?
Every 3 months.
Right, it's a new year. I haven't got over the weekend
yet.
You're in charge of all this stuff.
I haven't got over the weekend yet.
Sometimes we just get opportunities presented to us.
Get thrown a softball.
Yeah, that could be in the promo. So when you do get the grants, do they tend to be for very narrow, specific things that are easier to trace, or does it tend to be more broad in scope so that it takes even more effort to be able to figure out, is it being used right? Is it being used in a timely fashion? The reports all being done properly, that kind of stuff.
We write them very specific for goals that we have that we know we can be accountable for and report on. So like Measure Z is written with specific positions and then how other monies are spent. So it's easy to document that. OTS the same way. When we did the OTS grant, we came up with what type of enforcement operations we wanted to do over a 12-month period. So we know going into it what our necessary goals are to meet during the life of the grant. So it makes it a lot easier to not only meet those goals, but to report back on those because it is pretty specific and not as broad.
As you mentioned goals, I was writing down that same word. But I also followed up with a couple. How do you know if it's successful? When you do the grant writing, are you looking? I know the more specific you get, the more difficult it is to achieve. Got it. So you really don't want to put yourself in a corner, but on the other hand, you also want to know if this thing's working or not. How does that get balanced out, and how specific do you get with some of these grants that you want to reduce by X percent or X number, or you want to be able to have so many visits to the schools and expose a message to X number of kids? How do you quantify that?
Measure Z is data-driven. So our CSET team is very data-driven. Commander LaFrance is very data-driven. So we look at calls for service. We look at their amount of self-initiated activity versus their ability to be proactive. How many mental health holds do we divert away from the hospital, away from 5150 holds, actually putting them in SV, to other sources like their care providers, their other teams out there in the county that can provide those same sources. So that's pretty easy. That one's pretty easy to look at because we have that data. That's we're a police department. That's all the things we do is, you know, around that type of data. OTS is a little more difficult. I can tell you we can write, you know, 1,000 tickets during the OTS grant of primary collision factors, so speeding, running red lights, running stop signs. If the traffic collisions don't go down during that time period or the following time period, then how can you say we're successful? So that's a little more difficult to like put a tangible result on.
Yeah, measuring what didn't happen.
Yes.
Is kind of onerous, I guess, is the simplest way to think of it.
Yeah, we have officers. I just spoke one the other day. You know, he feels like on patrol he's not making a difference as he was in a specialty position where he had more time to focus and do things. But how do you know you're not making a difference when you don't know what the future, how you change the future,
whatever
what
it would just
have been,
happened? Yeah.
So trying to explain that to them that you're always making a difference. The enforcement always makes a difference because that one speeding ticket you wrote may have stopped that person from making the next intercession and T-boning somebody.
Or just being right there on the side of the road, how many people slow down because of that visible
reminder. That deterrence. It's a deterrent.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find those flashing signs do anything? The ones with the speed limits that flash?
Yes. We find that when we have a mobile trailer with a flashing speed sign on it, we will take that to neighborhoods, and we will get positive feedback from the neighborhoods of the influence
they'll
it has
see people
on traffic,
all of a sudden slowing down.
Slowing down and stuff. But, you know, you take it away, and it's gone again. So it's
very temporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
H&I, those areas work better. Safety corridor, honestly, lately, it's freeway out there. It's not a safety corridor anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I have intrigue looking at the license plate trims to see where people are from. They're not as many out of the areas as you would like to think. KINS, it's News and Information Time. It's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Meet Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It is 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Assistant Police Chief Brian Stevens from Eureka PD. Brian, you mentioned the CSAT and some of the different approaches that are now being used. You know, they certainly are different in the last 15 or 20 years than what they were. The concept of mental health was never really referenced. Yeah, it was guys being high, under the influence of, out of their mind, you know, that kind of stuff, were all temporary. And then maybe meth started happening a little bit more. And I can remember when Ray Shipley was the head honcho talking about tarball heroin. So what is that? And it was being flown in. And that was the big, you're smiling, like, yeah, okay, you remember that too. Things have changed so dramatically now. Are we able to handle the mental health situations that you guys run into, that we run into as citizens in the community? Are we prepared for that, or is it so overwhelming or so different that it's more of a survival, more of a dealing with it, but not really being able to address it?
I think your last statement is probably the closest that relates to what we're trying to do now. We're trying to deal with it in the manner that best assists us in assisting the clients that are on the street. But are we prepared and completely in a time where we can actually address it from a more global, even a county standpoint? That system is broken and it's not working the way it needs to. And it's a shame because we know about this. We've known about it for years. CSET's been up and running since 2018, so we've made it a priority to try to address this for the last 4 years. And while we have made incredible gains and partnerships and have changed lives of many clients in our community, when you're out there, you feel like you're drowning because it's every day in your face and you're still seeing it. We know that mental health's been around forever. Mental health issues have been around forever. It was a lot of times disguised by the narcotics use and being under the influence. And as we become more aware of what the situations are and how that closely reflects and has a correlation with drug use, we're now realizing there's a lot of codependent people who are both using drugs, have mental health issues. You have to get rid of the drugs to see the mental health issues, properly diagnose that. But that all takes time. And in our system, we don't have that time built in.
Well, and staff also.
Incredibly.
Not sure what department necessarily, but somebody to monitor, to help, to deal with, so you don't. You know, I know you guys know the regulars because you see them, but for most of us, we don't know who is what because either we're passing by in non-regular situations or these folks are in different settings. So it's not always seeing, okay, that's Bob. He's always talking to himself. He's pushing a cart and he's got a red sleeping bag. We see him there every morning at 8:15. Ting, ting, ting. It's not that kind of a situation for those of us that are outside. But you're right. Yeah, it seems like it's just overwhelming.
It is. And it takes a toll on our personnel because they're trying and they're out there and they deal with it. But we do have wins. We recently helped an individual who we were getting 80 to 100 calls on a year, who was responsible for building a lot of the pallet houses and pallet buildings in Eureka. Tens of thousands of pounds of trash and garbage we've had to take down. Finally got him back to a family out of the area, got him out of that shelter. The family took him out of the shelter we got him back there for, and he texted one of our employees the other day that he needs a letter from the DA's office. He's out of the shelter. He's doing great. He thanked the individual officers that, you know, were probably a nuisance to him at times because they were making him accountable for his actions. But now that his mind is clear and he's getting the help and he's in a better place, he realizes that they probably saved his life and got him to where he's at today. And he's got a job. And so it takes, you know, that how do you tell people it's going to take a year of constant daily interactions and accountability and compassion to get somebody like that to a place to where they're a productive member of a community again.
Or maybe to get them there.
Potentially,
I mean, if there was a finish line, okay, you could work towards that, but no guarantees.
Yeah, and we deal with people like that every day. You know, we offer services every day, and 99% of the time they're turned down. And when you catch that one moment, though, when they're at rock bottom and they say, I need help, you got to have that resource on the other end ready to go. You know, waterfront, now that it's
well,
back
that
open.
Well, that was a question also. Is the group of service providers, are they available? So if you have somebody and they need, oh, sorry, you know, it's after hours. We don't have enough staff. Funding isn't there.
Challenges. Okay. Those are all challenges we deal with. And COVID honestly set us back. A lot of those resources had to shut down, had to scale back because of COVID. So I think, you know, it's you see that curve. We were, I think, making great headway prior to 2020. And even early 2020, COVID hit. We lose a lot of the resources. You want to throw somebody in a crisis, change the schedule of someone who has mental health issues and change their environment because now they're all having to eat outside at free meal, you know, around other people that they normally are not around. And so you change that, you put people in a different level of crisis, and now we're still playing catch up to some of those effects of those changes.
That's what I was thinking, that the legacy of that is a lot longer than what I think a lot of us would ever imagine.
Yeah, may not be wearing masks no more, but the effects are going to be lasting for quite a while.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft Salad Dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning. Happy New Year, everybody. Joining us this morning on the show is Brian Stevens, the Assistant Police Chief for Eureka. Brian, looking at some of the challenges that we do have, I guess you could say cultural challenges. Okay, fine, if we want to go foo-foo. Are there communities that are seeing significant traction with mental health-related issues? You know, outside looking in, it seems like for everyone you get, squared up, find a home, find their family, there's somebody else backfilling immediately. You know, it's not a fixed number that you can work down. It's like there's capacity, and when somebody leaves, somebody else shows up. Are there communities that you're aware of, whether it's in California or elsewhere, that are seeing the number actually reduce?
Yeah, I've not seen any numbers from, you know, or studies from different cities that's seen the numbers reduce. I know there are cities who have programs that have become very successful, and so they're putting out a lot more higher success rates of how do we get individuals off the streets, properly cared for, and in back into society. And even locally, Uplift, Pathway to Paydays, those types of job training programs that the city has been very effective in helping a core group of people each 4 months or so to get back to a productive lifestyle.
Yeah, I would think not that it's low-hanging fruit, because that's not fair. But with the need for so many people to be employed, you know, you talk to any business person, you know, and they're everybody's looking for somebody. So it's not that there's no jobs available. It's the lack of interest in, or the lack of ability to fulfill some of these functions. I would think now would be a golden opportunity for some of these programs, if they are indeed looking to get these folks squared mm-hmm. up and cleaned up, to be able to have some tremendous successes. You know, the fear a lot of us have is that, well, if we don't have as many people to deal with, then we don't need as much staff, we don't have as much staff, our budget shrinks, and we kind of put ourselves out of business, and I still got 15 years I want to work.
Yeah.
You know, and whether or not that's based in fact or that's just perception, who knows? But I would, are there those chances to connect with the business community?
Yeah, there are through that program for sure. I think they have roughly 20 to 25 different businesses that show up for interviews. So this program walks them through getting driver's licenses, making sure that they can write a resume, how to do interviews, do mock interviews. And then they actually have companies come and interview them. And I think it's like 90% come back for a second interview. So the opportunity is there and kind of puts it back on them now. So we've gotten you here. You've gotten you the interviews. You've got the job. Now it's time for you to flourish. But that's on you. We can't.
That personal responsibility thing, that I would think that that's something that's been missing for a significant portion of the time when they were in their previous life setting.
Yeah, that goes away because it's not the top of their priority list. So getting them to realize that has to be their new priority is I'm responsible for myself and what I do from here on out.
Is there an acceptance by a large percentage of those folks that go through the program, or those that you guys have contact with?
Once they get to that level, yeah, they have come back around. They realize that this is my opportunity now to make my life better. I'm not requiring, relying on someone else to make it better. This is my, they've got me here. Now it's my time to step up and do what's right.
Now, you use the word hit bottom, triggering event. I mean, there's all kinds of different things. Are there any consistencies with that, with the folks that you guys interact with or you get feedback from later on? This happened and lights went off, or, you know, I saw a buddy and things didn't work out well for them, and that's when I figured out it was time for me to figure my life out.
Yeah, there are a couple different like categories. We have that core group of people who, during economic downfalls and they lose their jobs because of COVID, whatever, find themselves to become homeless and on the streets or living out of their car. They're the ones we see probably the highest level of success through the program because they've been there before and they want to get back there, and they just need the help to get there.
That's the helping hand.
That's the helping hand, helping up, lift them up, not a handout, but a lift them up to the next level. Then we have the group where, it's tougher because of the mental health issues and trying to get them there. And then we have a group where it's either they don't have the capabilities no more, or they've taken that life of, this is what I'm going to do. And they will never take resources from us or assistance from us. And that's more of the criminal element of the population we see in our green belts and around the city.
So with the predator crowd, is the criminal justice system serving the community with those folks? Or are those the ones that we hear that get processed, they don't get sentenced even if they're convicted, and they get kicked back out and they just kind of keep stirring the pudding?
That is that piece of the culture that is going to have to eventually change. I know there is like Prop 4757, how that all began, that, it's just incredible change in how we deal with low-level crimes And when you look at a lot of that criminal element that is roaming the streets, that's the types of crimes they're committing, which creates the most quality of life issues for our community. They're stealing stuff out of your yard. They're stealing from the stores. There's no consequence for that. There's some movement in the legislation right now to get some of those laws back to the voters, but we're looking at 2024 before, by the time if it got through the legislative process to get back on the ballot, it's the fall of 2024. So what do we do in the meantime? And that's where the culture needs to change, that they have to be held accountable to make a quality of life change in our community.
Well, hopefully this year we'll see some of that movement. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Say it with a smile this time.
Happy New Year.
All right. See everybody tomorrow.